Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm Hila Follett, Professor of Philosophy at East Tennessee State University. My guest this evening is Walter Feinberg, Professor in the Department of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and we're going to be discussing affirmative action. Glad to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Let's begin. Affirmative action programs once seemed to enjoy a great deal of support, certainly among politicians, among academicians, and I think even the public at large. In the last few years, though, the programs have come under attack really from both the left and the right to varying degrees. I take it, though, that you think that affirmative action programs still deserve our support, that there are good arguments in favor of affirmative action. And I wonder if you could briefly outline the reasons that you favor affirmative action, and then we can go back and look at each of them in some detail.
I think before I do, one of the things that we have to consider in regard to the disfavor that affirmative action is receiving in some quarters, and that's certainly not true of all quarters, is the context of the times right now where the economic well-being of the country is certainly not being shared by everyone, and people feel especially vulnerable. And the vulnerability can be tracked to many sources, perhaps largely the mobility of capital and the immobility of labor, but where people can't direct their energies at corporations that are sitting in Korea or some other place doing business, it's easier to turn to local targets, and affirmative action certainly seems like an appropriate target, even though in many cases what's being targeted is the least advantaged people in the society. So one has to keep that context in mind when considering what some of the reasons for the disfavor of affirmative action is, because whether the arguments for affirmative action are right or wrong, the problem is much wider and much more systemic than affirmative action itself. Now, putting that in context, I think that the affirmative action meets some important goals of American society. It serves to enhance equal opportunity by assuring or trying to assure that groups that have systematically been discriminated in the past will not be discriminated against in the future. It helps the standing of members of previously excluded groups, and thereby helps to remove cultural and educational barriers to advancement. And finally, and I think this is sometimes overlooked, for some groups it's an important way to pay back a historical debt that's owed.
Okay. Let's look at each of those in more detail. The first one you said is to enhance equal opportunities. How specifically does affirmative action achieve that goal?
Well, it makes sure that a wide net is cast for filling positions. Let me take us back about 30 years or so. When I entered the university, the usual way in which people received positions was that a friend of their professor at another university called him, and it usually was a him, and asked if there were any good graduate students coming out. That professor would say, yes, I have so-and-so, and he's coming out, and if he was liked by the employing university, then he would be hired. There was no requirement that there be a nationwide search. Sometimes that was done, but oftentimes it was a back of the hand kind of thing. So one of the things that affirmative action has done is to assure that in many positions that there is in fact a search that's carried out nationwide, and that the best candidates are selected for the positions. So that's one way in which it's helped.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, it, given that description, and that certainly seems to be right from what I know about the old boy system in universities, actually then the beneficiaries of at least that part of affirmative action are not just going to be minorities or women, but other individuals who might have been overlooked in the past simply because they didn't have the appropriate connections.
That's exactly right, and that's the part of affirmative action that's often underplayed by its critics. And what's the critics create some kind of Edenesque past in which supposedly everyone was chosen on the basis of their highest merit, etc., etc. That past never existed, and we're probably a bit closer to it now than we were back then.
Okay, so that genuinely, on your view, affirmative action helps create equal opportunities for everyone to some degree and not just minorities.
Exactly.
Okay. But your particular concern about it has to do with those groups that have been previously excluded.
Yes.
And could you talk a little bit about how affirmative action achieves those goals?
Well, there are a number of ways that it achieves them. I think one of the things that affirmative action does is to aim to improve the standing of groups that have been stigmatized in education and in work. Now, the stigmatization could be for different reasons. African Americans were stigmatized by a history of slavery and race discrimination and a history of a kind of ideological disempowerment. The latest example of that would be the bell curve. Women, on the other hand, are discriminated against because of a past history in which there was a gendered division of labor, which for whatever reason seems to be inappropriate to the present time. But in many people's minds, men as well as women, the idea of a gendered division of labor still exists. So affirmative action, by opening up opportunities for women, by trying to find ways to increase opportunities for African American and other people of color, provides avenues for people whose talents have been overlooked in the past to express those talents in the present.
Okay. Now, in both cases you talked about this history of discrimination, and I take it that leads into your third point, which is that society has a debt to be paid. Mm-hmm. A debt to be paid to discriminated groups, especially, I suppose, Afro-Americans, and that affirmative action is one way of repaying that debt.
Yes. I think the debt is owed especially to two groups, African-Americans and Native Americans. Those two groups, because of the history of those groups, are very different than the history of other groups in this country, in the sense that no other people were involuntarily shackled in order to come here or to remain here, as in the case of Native Americans. That is, other groups came because of hardships where they were, and they came here to improve their lot. African Americans have a very different history, and that debt, in my mind, has not only not been paid, it hasn't been adequately acknowledged.
When you say that debt has not been adequately acknowledged, I take it then that part of what you think is that affirmative action will help pay the debt, but by itself will not completely pay the debt. There are other things that you think need to be done as well.
That's right. But it certainly is a step in the right direction. I think a good deal of thinking needs to be done about what additional steps are required to pay that very special debt, but it certainly is a step, and it needs to be thought of in that way, because if it's thought of as just a way to correct inequalities in general, then no group has a special claim, and I believe that some African Americans have a very special claim.
Right. Okay. Let's pause briefly for the benefit of anyone who may be tuning in late. I'm Hila Follett. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest this evening is Walter Feinberg, professor in the Department of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and we're discussing affirmative action. Eventually, I may want to come back and at least get you to speculate about what else needs to be done, but let's turn and look at some of the objections which people have to affirmative action. And in a way, they spring from what you were just talking about. On your view, what you just described is that affirmative action starts to pay the debt, but doesn't pay the debt in full. The implication is that there are other things that we need to do to pay off that debt.
Do you mind if I come in here a moment?
Sure.
Because the character of the debt is something special that I think needs to be clarified. When I speak about a debt that's owed, to me, the debt that's owed is first and foremost owed to the slaves that lived in this country and that essentially made the country prosper. Their descendants are recipients of that unpaid debt, but it's important to clarify that the debt is owed because of what slaves did for us, and that it's owed to people who are their descendants.
Okay. Well, in fact, that allows us to discuss one of the objections which people often have, which is that the people who have to pay the debt that you're talking about are thought to be people who aren't the guilty parties. And so even if we ought to pay a debt, affirmative action isn't the way to do it, because the people who have to pay are not the people who enslaved Afro-Americans. What's your response to that criticism?
Well, part of that criticism is absolutely right, that these people are not guilty, but that's because none of us are guilty in the sense of having abused slaves, if that's the source of the debt. That, however, doesn't mean that we haven't benefited from the abuse that was perpetrated. And then the question is whether, having benefited, by virtue of that benefit, there's something owed. Now, not every time that we benefit unduly from something do we owe a debt. Suppose, for example, that I'm Jewish and I go to rent a place and the landlord happens to be anti-Semitic and doesn't rent to me. Then you come along and you're not Jewish and the landlord then rents to you. Well, in a sense, you're the indirect beneficiary of a discrimination against me, but there's nothing that you owe me as a result of that, of the discrimination, except that should that become come to light, it would obviously in some way have made housing cheaper for you, and insofar as the landlord had to pay, then your rent would go up. I believe that in the case of slavery, we have to see how a benefit is gained and then ask ourselves whether a debt is owed by virtue of that benefit. My sense is that the largest benefit that was gained is that in some abstract way, none of our ancestors had to do what slaves had to do to develop this country. That is, I like to think of a thought experiment where my grandparents came to this country around sometime during the last century. And they came to improve their lot. And indeed that happened. But suppose in the bargain somebody had said to them, well, you can go to America, and the chances are that when you get to America, your lot will be improved. But there's only one catch to this, and that is that America needs slaves to do some of its work. It needs slaves to pick its cotton, to plow its fields, especially in the South. Now, in the total population, perhaps 15% of the people are slaves, in the South, 50%. If you choose to go to America, you'll be put into a lottery, and there's a chance of that proportion that you'll wind up a slave. I think under that condition, my grandparents wouldn't have come here. And so there's a sense in which what the African slave did for all of us was to allow us to be here. And that's a tremendous benefit. Now, insofar as that, we've profited from that benefit, it seems to me that there's a debt owed to those who have not yet profited and who have allowed that benefit to have been.
Are there other benefits, too, over and beyond those? For instance, if forgetting slavery, if we go back to the days in which discrimination against Afro-Americans was very open and very explicit, blacks simply were not permitted into certain jobs. Our parents or grandparents then might have had an easier chance to get a job than they would have in a purely fair world. So there's a sense in which we are still the beneficiaries, sure, not just of slavery, but of of Jim Crow laws.
Very much so. The easiest and most visible way to see that is to look at athletics right now and to note all the black athletes and consider all the black athletes that were not allowed to play during years of Jim Crow, and then figure a generally reasonable proportion of talented black people in all of the profession and all of the areas, even the unions in which our grandparents were allowed to get their first foot up on the American dream, and imagine those people who were excluded. It made the competition easier.
Okay. Well, now, I suspect then your answer helps answer the next objection which people often raise against affirmative action, and that is that the people who primarily benefit from affirmative action programs aren't the people who really need or deserve it.
Well, you know, that depends on where affirmative action's being directed, and it depends on where the law is at any given point in time. There's a certain truth to it. Insofar as a large number minority people and African Americans have not had the opportunity even to get into the bidding for jobs, that means at that level affirmative action isn't going to be helpful. That's one reason why I believe the debt has to go beyond affirmative action. But on the other hand, if you look at the actual figures, the increases for African Americans has come most at the working class end of things, blue collar jobs, law enforcement, fire, etc., etc. Very limited advancement has come with professions. Actually, I was just looking at figures recently, and something like one-tenth of 1% increase in African-American lawyers and judges over the last 10 or 12 years or so. It's an incredibly small amount when you think of all the hullabaloo that's being raised about affirmative action programs in law schools and medical schools. The increase has been shamefully small. But there has been, for African-Americans, advances in blue-collar work, and for women, there has been advances in professional fields.
Okay. One last objection which people often raise against affirmative action programs is that it stigmatizes all blacks or all women. In fact, I've heard this, and I'm sure you have too. People at the university see that a black or a woman is in some kind of high administrative position, perhaps a dean, and the temptation is to say, wow, she got that only because she was a woman, or he or she got that only because he or she was black. And the claim is that this somehow stigmatizes people who are it stigmatizes both people who are directly beneficiaries of the programs and perhaps some people who aren't, but who just happen to be members of a certain minority or a certain gender. Now, is that a serious problem, in your view?
What's problematic about that is the perception. I mean, I don't know that the stigma is a problem because people are stigmatizing. It's not necessarily a problem of those who are being stigmatized. Let me put it this way. When the old boy network was in full blossom, I never heard anybody complain because there were a few people who probably were put in positions that they really weren't quite up to, that all white men were incompetent and unable to perform, and they only got there because somehow or other they were favored of their professors. The objection begs the question. Clearly, there are many African Americans and many women who do not need affirmative action. All they need is generally the general standards at which everybody will compete under. But the point is not that. The point is whether affirmative action allows us to make better decisions in terms of jobs and in terms of education. And the answer to that question doesn't depend just on test scores or grades. Test scores and grades are symbolic stand-ins for something else, for what we expect people to be able to do and how we expect them to be able to perform. Now, the qualities that we may need to have in, let's say, our lawyers or our doctors, if we're talking about university people, may obviously include the ability to study and to grasp the point of the law and to practice medicine efficiently. But it may also include other qualities like an ability and a willingness and a skill to service populations that are underserved in our country. And if that's the case, then the kind of selection standards that we need have to go beyond the traditional grades and test scores. And if they don't, then what we're going to have is a population that's going to continue the inequalities and services that we presently have. So we need to think beyond test scores, and we need to think beyond grades. And insofar as women and African Americans satisfy these other qualities, they have to be factored in as very important considerations.
Okay. Let me go back to something you said a moment ago. You said that in some regards, at least, affirmative action has not had very much success at all. You gave the figure of, I believe you said, 0.5% increase in the number of lawyers, black lawyers and judges in the past dozen years.
Yeah, the figure I'm quoting is something like 0.1%.
Okay.
Now, you know, I'm not going to swear to that particular figure,
yeah.
But it's not...
It's certainly very
high.
Low.
Yeah.
It's certainly very low. Now, why? I mean, actually, there's sort of a two-part question. One, why has it not been as successful as it should have been? And the second part of the question is, why do most people assume that it has been so successful in a way that it's disadvantaged white males?
Well, you know, I think there is a perception problem that whenever somebody is turned down for a position, it's kind of easy to blame affirmative action for that. And so there is a problem of perception. It's interesting to me, though, why it hasn't been successful. That is, in the areas that I'm citing. I honestly don't know the answer to that. But my guess is that the will to achieve equity in this country really lost its steam around 1980. And we've been treading water ever since that time. And that, I mean, it takes an effort. It takes both some money and it takes an educational effort to take someone in who may not have had the advantage of a private school education or an the kind of education that you would get within a wealthy suburb, and to move that person along into professional areas. It can be done, and it has been done, but to do it requires some money, and it requires political will, and it requires an educational system that's sensitive to those kinds of issues. I think somewhere along in the early 1980s, we lost our will to do that, and we need to get it back.
Okay. Well, now we're running down on time here. How do we get it back? Because I take it part of the issue is not just whether there are arguments favoring affirmative action, you think there are, but that we no longer have the political will. A lot of people, certainly not everyone, but a lot of people are now opposed to affirmative action. How do people go about to reasserting the importance of the role of affirmative action?
I think there are two levels in which the issue has to be addressed, and I want to come back to what I said right at the beginning, that the attack on affirmative action is in part being generated because of reasons that you can understand. There's a vulnerability in America right now. People are worried that their jobs are not secure, or they won't be receiving jobs. I think we need, as a nation, to begin to address that, because if people are worried and afraid, their ability to listen to arguments about the fairness for the other guy is diminished, as it would be with anyone. So that's one area that we have to attend to. The other is that we really have to begin to invest a great deal in raising educational opportunities of youngsters at all levels of our educational system, and that includes making sure that people who are impoverished are not diminished spiritually by that impoverishment.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
I've been talking with Walter Feinberg, professor of the Department of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good evening.